way to start and think about your work and you yourself as an artist, and not limit yourself, is to understand that we as humans need art in order to preserve our collective culture and our collective history, right? And it's a necessary thing. It's not just some, you know, extra thing we tap on, and you know, it's just as important as furniture, food.
Marina, you might be the most positive guest that we have had on this, and I feel like right now might be. Marshall, do you want to do an introduction, or should I?
Yes. Welcome, everyone, to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm here again with Josh, Dina, and our very special guest, Marina Press. What?
It's Marina Granger.
It's Marina Granger? Like Hermione?
Yeah, like Hermione Granger.
Oh, where did you get Press from?
That's my maiden name.
Honestly, like, so Marina, also congratulations on getting married. But it hasn't been that long since you.
I know. And I still haven't. It hasn't been long enough for me to change my Gmail. So
okay.
I'm sorry. I should have. I mean, I started, you know, this like new business, and I got married, and it's this whole different part of my life. It's like the next chapter. So it's cool that I have a new last name to go with it.
That's awesome. And your husband is creative as well, right?
Yeah.
What's that like, being married to another creative?
It's amazing.
Ah, good.
Amazing. I guess, you know, it's also, it's great because we control our own schedules. We're living this like bohemian lifestyle, so to speak, where we can like wake up to, you know, at whatever hour we please. Oh, I like to wake up early. And he sleeps in because he is a DJ, and sometimes he works till 4 a.m, spinning at like the coolest clubs.
That's awesome.
But he's also able to request things. He knows how to ask for things and speak for himself because he's always worked for himself, and he doesn't rely on going to like a manager or going to someone else and asking for permission for what he wants. So, for example, whatever you want, you just do it.
Oh.
And this is something that he taught me that's really special, and I think I wouldn't have learned unless we were both creatives and both working for ourselves.
Huh. So how would that apply to, like, an artist, like a painter, to just... Is that licensed to ask people for shows, or what do you mean?
Well, it's about asking for what you want and being okay with asking for what you want and whatever it is that you want, right? So you either want a, you know, you might want a gallery show, you might want to sell your work to collectors, you might want 500,000 followers on Instagram, you might want to teach a painting class, you know, somewhere upstate as part of a retreat. And then you put these ideas on yourself sometimes, thinking like, I can't do that. I'm not good enough. I don't think I'm there yet. You just do it. And that's part of not asking anyone, to just doing it and getting it out there.
Other than the fact that you're amazing and you're creative and you have a new last name, can you kind of tell, so most of the people that we've had here, either artists or, you know, interspersed with a few, you know, gallery directors, and you are actually neither of these things. So I feel like, is this a good time to talk about the artist advisory, or should we start with your childhood? Or, you know,
start with my childhood.
Yeah. I actually think Marina has had the exact same childhood as I did, because every single Russian immigrant
came
to America. Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh. Everyone who came to America at about the same time we did kind of had the same childhood.
I didn't know that she came from Russia. So, yeah, tell me about
that. You can't tell that I have an accent.
No.
She doesn't have an accent.
No. I should.
I have a speech impediment. Sometimes I write it off as, you know, guys, it's my Belarusian accent. No one in Belarus can, you know, pronounce the letter S.
I'm terrified that now if I speak Russian to a Russian speaker that lives in a Russian-speaking area, they won't understand me because I would have a very heavy English accent. But, you know, but that's not the only thing I, you know, learned in the old country. I'm happy to talk about how I grew up.
I would love to, yeah. Where did you grow up?
So I lived in Kyiv, Ukraine up until I was 6 years old.
Okay.
And I grew up in a Jewish family. So we came here as Soviet Jewish refugees in 1991. And right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there were so many Soviet Jewish refugees coming to the United States, but also going to Israel. And I believe Dina is one of them. There are, at one point, the statistic was like something about 500,000 Soviet Jewish refugees were in Brooklyn alone.
Wow. But by the way, did you guys come like the kind of the Eastern European refugee road?
We went from Kiev to Moscow and flew right into JFK.
Yeah, wow. And you must have been like the first wave that did that because so my family left a year earlier than hers did, and we still had to go through like this entire kind of. Just, you know, like you go to one country, wait to get documents to go to the next country, then you stay in that country until you get documents to. And I mean, it was like a 6 month process to come, or, you know, 6 months to a year to go to the US. So you guys must have, like, just missed that.
Probably.
Which was also, by the way, the best part of my childhood because I got to not be in Belarus.
You were in Italy and stuff.
We were in Vienna. Yeah, we were in Vienna for a while, and then we were in Italy for a while. And it was like being in a capitalist country after kind of growing up where I did was spectacular.
I mean, we basically came from a government that was. You know, you could compare it to just the most bland mashed potatoes. That was everybody's life.
Wow. So you were six when you landed in Canada?
Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, before I moved here, even though I do compare the Soviet Union to a very bland existence, my grandparents who raised me, my mother was just preoccupied, I guess. She was too hard for her.
Because that's the Russian way, actually.
That's the Russian way.
They live with you and they raise the kids.
So they raised me, but they were avid art collectors, as much as they could be. My grandfather was an oral surgeon, and he fought in World War II, and my grandmother taught literature to high school students, but then also taught teachers how to teach.
Okay.
So pedagogy. And so they tried to be as cultured as possible, and so did my mother. She lived in St. Petersburg, and I would visit her often, and she would take me to the Hermitage and something called Tsarskoe Selo.
Which is where all the intellectuals kind of had their summer houses.
So. Totes. but it's just, you know, like a beautiful palace that Peter the Great, I think, built. But anyway, my first studio visit, I must have been under 5 years old. And I remember the smell of the paints.
Wow.
And this is something that really stuck with me. And it was just kind of like, I saw the studio and I thought, oh my God, this is so cool.
Huh.
My next experience was when, kind of aha moment in the art world, was when I came here already. I was in New York City and my mother took me to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And I mean, after I realized where I was and what it was, and it must have been like 7 or 8 years old, my first thought was, what is happening behind these walls, because I know there's offices here. And also, who decides what goes on these walls? Like, why this thing? You know,
interesting. What a strange thought for a 7-year-old at the museum.
I was just full of curiosity. And so I pursued studying art history. I knew I wasn't going to be an artist. I just didn't have, I always tell myself I don't have the talent, but I also don't have that kind of mind. And so I studied art history, and I went to college here in New York City, and then I started working in the art world and went to start my graduate degree and finished it recently.
Oh, but congratulations.
Thank
Isn't that
you.
Another part of the new life?
Part of the new life. But I was done with my coursework before I took my first serious gallery job. And so I kind of went on hiatus after that.
Okay.
And I worked in commercial art galleries.
How did you find the New York art gallery scene?
Well, you know, it was funny that you asked. Well, it's funny that you ask. Of course it's funny. It's not. I just told you I work in galleries. Okay. So I, my first job in the art world was at a museum.
Okay.
And then I thought, this place is moving way too slow for me. I need to work in a gallery.
Were you deciding what goes on the walls like you thought about as a 7-year-old in the museum?
Yeah. I was hoping to make those decisions.
Yeah, and instead you were like, oh, actually, oh God, what goes on the walls is made out of, you know, it, like that decision is made by a committee of 50 people and takes about 3 years.
Yeah. There's just a lot of politics, which I was totally cool with. With, like, playing that game and being in that world, I just wanted more experience. My mind moved too fast.
Okay.
And so I went and I worked at a small gallery on the Lower East Side that was a result of the economic crash of 2007-08.
Oh, so what year was, because I was an art student then, and that felt so monumental for artist.
Oh my gosh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was like good and bad at the same time.
Uh-huh.
This was 2008, I think I started working there.
Wow.
And the gallery was opened by a former director of a bigger Chelsea gallery.
Okay.
And this was the trend for the Lower East Side. There were galleries popping up in 2008, maybe 2009. Only maybe 10% of them are still open there.
Wow.
But there were so many that were opening, giving artists all sorts of opportunities, artists that would be that might not fly in Chelsea because their work was maybe not as expensive. Maybe they were emerging artists and collectors, big collectors, like, the Rima Hort Mann Foundation would come around, and the Rubels, they would go to the Lower East Side and pick out a bunch of artwork because for them, it was fun and accessible.
Huh. It was like shopping for candy.
It was like shopping for candy. And the idea was that they would pick out artists with the right credentials that they thought would kind of push the value of their work up in the future.
So we
would always, you know, talk about how many artists went to Yale at a certain gallery, you know, like how many Yaleys do these guys represent? Because that's one of the things that they would look for.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like if someone went to Yale, and I guess Columbia is probably the other one, but Yale is like the big one. If you gamble on
RISD.
On those.
Well, and then I went and I worked at a more traditional niche gallery, but what was different there was people weren't really buying the work as an investment, right? People were buying the work because they liked it.
Okay.
We had a few collectors that treated it a little bit like an investment, but it wasn't really, you know, for this gallery, people just wanted to come in, buy the work, and we wanted them to keep buying so we could pay the rent.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And so fast forward to 2016 and even to now. So that gallery has since closed because they were unable to afford the rent, but probably because there were some other issues as well. But moving on. Right now, I'm seeing that there are galleries that are closing their doors. And it's almost as fast as it happened in 2008. But we don't see it happening that way. For example, Emeringer Yoey is now Miles McEnroy Gallery. And so that means that one of the partners went and opened up their own gallery.
Okay.
But that gallery is gone, and so I don't know if all the artists are there. You know, things like that. It's kind of falling.
I mean, we've had like, I don't know how many. Has it been four or five galleries? Galleries kind of on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And other than old Frank Bernarducci, who used to work for, everyone else is closing their physical space. And mm-hmm. everyone else kind of, you know, like, and I mean, I guess some of them didn't talk about it on the podcast, but told us later. Some of them kind of talked about it directly here, but it's not going to come out for six more months. But yeah, I feel like, I mean, I don't know if maybe we jinx people. Maybe, you know.
No, it's not you. You guys. It's galleries. Galleries are just closing. And they're closing, I think, also not because the times are hard, but also I think good galleries are staying open and the ones that are in it for the wrong reasons are closing.
What would be the wrong reasons?
It's kind of a really long answer, I think. I feel like I'm already.
But you might actually have some. these podcasts tend to run way too long anyway, so yeah. You can't. Okay. At least you would be talking about
revenue
the art world
not our
and not.
Yet.
I think maybe that should be our motto, our grind. Brevity has never been our strong suit.
I told you we'd come up with something. Okay, so I think galleries that are in it for the right reasons. Let's go into the past. Let's go to Leo Castelli Gallery in the 70s. Okay. Leo Castelli would oftentimes say no to collectors when they wanted to buy something because he didn't feel like it was the right collection for that artist. He cared about the artist more than the collector.
Okay.
And now there are galleries throughout time, there have been galleries that really care about selling. They are selling mostly for themselves, not for the artist. Mm-hmm. They don't want to evolve the artist's career or grow their market. They just want to pay their rent. And these galleries are akin to stores. But there are some galleries that are small and surviving very, very well. And those galleries, I'm just, you know, it's not a commercial for them, but for example, Canada Gallery is having a big show for Catherine Bradford right now. And they have the opportunity to sell every single painting to a collector, but they are selling them to the right people. And if the chance comes up for them to put it in a museum collection, even if it's not a sure shot, they would rather hold off on selling it to the private collector and put it in a museum, even if they have to wait. Mm. And these types of galleries are in it for the right reasons. They're there to evolve the artist's work and grow their market. Mm. And so the galleries that are closing, they're closing because their greed has caught up with them.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Well, that's funny because Levine on here was talking about art sales are retail was what he was saying. And it's like, you're saying the opposite.
He was also quite drunk.
See, I didn't fall for that. I'm drinking Pellegrino.
Marina's sober and she went, yeah.
And I'm still giving weird answers.
But you would fundamentally sort of disagree with that idea as your
but
art
I mean, he
is
was saying
retail,
he was saying two
right?
different things. He was saying art is just retail, but I'm not just in it for the money. And that might have been like him versus the drink talking, the drink versus him talking.
Well, look, I don't know him personally, but I know his gallery, and I really don't think he's in it for the money because. Right. Of the way his artists' careers have evolved, and he's part of like a subculture in the art world, and it's really, I think the work that he does is important. And
I
for
too.
I mean,
I
that's
think
actually
a really
why we,
beautiful
yeah,
I mean,
I think that's
yeah.
why we wanted him here because, like, he's not, you know,
he's yeah,
like he's not just dealing in kind of like generic Chelsea art.
Yeah, and the other thing is for someone like that, his art market that he caters to is a little bit different than everybody else. Because these people, you know, could have grown up reading High Fructose and right. really, really wanting one of these pop surrealist paintings, and now they can't afford it and they buy it. But before that, they were buying prints. Uh-huh. And Jonathan was smart enough to allow his artists to make prints to build this kind of brand loyalty mm-hmm. to his artists, so that when these collectors have grown enough financially and had enough money to buy the work, the actual originals, they will. Mm-hmm. And
right,
that's something
right.
really, really special.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So just making prints off the work and making it accessible makes him like a standout guy, I think.
Interesting.
But again, his art market is different from everybody else's.
Right. Right.
So, when I realized while I was doing all of this, I also took a year off from the art world.
Okay.
As a sort of career palate cleanser. And what I do is I offer advice to artists, both practical advice and conceptual advice, because I notice that the landscape of the art world is changing so much that artists that do have dealers, their dealers and gallerists might not have enough time to spend with the artist, kind of going over their career and talking about a strategy to get to their goal. And every artist's goal is different. Not everybody wants to sell work for millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And there are some artists that just want people to have their work. Mm-hmm. And so what I decided to do one day, essentially, is to start a business called The Artist Advisory, which is one of the first of its kind that offers honest, unbiased advice to artists. And even if you have a dealer, he might be a little, or he or she, or they, might be a little bit biased, even if they're not even trying to be, mm-hmm. because they have a business to run. And even if you're their top seller, they might not want to evolve your work and let you spread your wings and, you know, fly away to the next gallery because they don't want to lose you
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because you're paying their rent.
Right. Right.
And if you're there, not a top-selling artist, they just don't have time for you. So
right.
it's really, and not all dealers are like this. And I just want to talk also later, maybe if we have time, about the different kinds of art galleries that artists should look into if they want to be represented by galleries. But that also goes to say that there are artists that don't need galleries. With the internet today, people are selling their work independent of galleries.
Right.
And they're selling work off Instagram. They're selling work off auctions, like online auctions, or out of their studio.
Mm-hmm.
And they're forming a personal connection with each and every one of their followers, their collectors, and maybe they just need someone that will guide them into growing their career independent of a gallery. So that's also where I come in.
Hmm. And full disclosure, I did a session with you and I found it extremely helpful.
Thank you. Your
advice was really smart. I was telling my girlfriend after, I felt really positive about everything. And Like, it had some really good advice for moving someone like me forward, for sure.
Can you teach Marshall how to use Gmail? I feel like Gmail. Yeah, could your services involve like
that falls under the practical part. But first, I of course need to learn how to use it. So
you had techniques that I found really interesting. Do you want to? Are those surprises when you meet someone, or would you want to talk about any of those?
I'm totally happy to tell you what some of them are.
And by the way, I feel like so many people listening to this are emerging artists. Mm-hmm. So,
oh my gosh, I have a whole laundry list of advice for people. But Marshall, when I met with you and when I meet with other artists, the one thing I try to do is I try to know as little as possible about them, mm-hmm. because I want to hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak, what the artist feels they're communicating with their work. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I like to listen to when their entire history of making art, and I process that, using my expert analytical skills.
Yeah, and like a notebook, like jotting down things. Yeah. It was like that portion felt a little bit like almost therapy.
Yeah.
But then I thought it was really clever. I was like, oh, wow, she's kind of getting to know me and to see if what I'm doing is successful in a way by my own metric, which is really fascinating.
And then my next step was to take a look at what your work is. And I look at how you present yourself to the world on the internet, because your branding as an artist is so important today. Mm-hmm. And branding goes all the way back to the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are at home listening. You can quickly Google, for example, there is the Roland Madonna, and there is the St. Luke painting the Virgin. And they're both by two separate artists who are contemporaries, and both paintings are almost copies of each other. And that's because both of these artists were from a similar area, but they were building on each other's brands.
Huh.
And one of them was the slightly older artist, and he would sell patterns to other studios, meaning formatting for paintings. Like, what does a Madonna and child look
need?
Like?
Yeah.
And, like, these patterns were recognizable amongst these people who were, while viewing the work. They weren't necessarily all buying. I mean, a lot of them were for churches and had a really strong religious function, but it dates back to then. Hmm. And, we're jumping forward to Andy Warhol. Like, he knew that you needed to brand yourself.
Right.
And he knew that everybody, you know, you could look at his Marilyn, you could look at his flowers, you could look at his soup cans, you'll know it's his work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we go on, there's other big, giant, mega artists like Damien Hirst and Jeff Koons and, you know, even Gata Merritt. Like, you know what their work looks like, and they have a brand.
Uh-huh.
But there's a thin line between creating your brand and selling out. So I love to listen to the artist's intentions so that whatever I tell them to do is still in line with their intentions, and they don't make work that will just sell, right? You need to make work that will make you happy, whether you want to sell it or not. And you need to make work that is in line with your intentions.
Hmm. Interesting.
So I guess, what are your next steps? You know, like, let's say someone like Marshall, you have your notebook.
Oh, yes.
You write that, you know, neither of you knows how to use Gmail, so you skip that
part. We're doing just
five of
those. Yeah. Yeah, but luckily, Marshall and I know how to use carrier pigeons.
Yes.
So that's how we communicate.
And for the record, Joshua, I feel like that's why we've been so left out on, like the last few interviews we've group and trying to set up with. I think the hawk ate Marshall's carrier pigeon.
Look, I'm doing smoke signals too. You guys should be catching these things.
Smoke signals. It's an art form. So, speaking of which, I also, after all of this, I make sure that I have a good understanding of what the artist's intentions are and what their goal is. And then I give them the advice they need, whatever it is. And, you know, in some cases, the artist is making a lot of work and selling it and they're mid-career and they've plateaued and what do they do next? In some cases, it's an emerging artist who just got out of art school and they don't know if they want to be an abstract painter or a photographer. And I do take a little bit of time. I give advice during the session, but I also take a little bit of time and I process everything at home in my happy place, my sacred area. And then I send this ginormous email recapping what we did, what we talked about, what they should do, which residencies they should apply to if they want to, if that's necessary for them, or which galleries they should look into, or what their next, what their recipe for success is. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, you just kind of focus. And that email is just like a focus plan for what I should do. Now, do you follow up with people?
You know, I do follow up with people. I have people who buy packages, and so they have several sessions with me, and I follow up with them often because I know they want to keep working with me. But I'm also, like, not a very hard sell, so I try not to, like, follow up and say, like, hey, do you want another session? But I do answer questions. You know, for example, I did one session with some guy straight out of art school, helped him tremendously, but he also keeps sending me like one line questions and it takes me 2 seconds to answer him. So I do it.
Okay.
You know, so I'm always like the stream of communication is always open. One thing I really try to do is I try to figure out where the self-doubt comes from and make it stop because it's a big no-no if you want to succeed, right? And I think a lot of the time, like you said, when you're young and just starting out, you don't have self-doubt. You're so sure of yourself because you aren't jaded yet. And also because you haven't heard a lot of limiting beliefs from other people. And one really remarkable thing that you have done with your career, Marshall, is you never stopped, right? You told me that when you were a teenager, you were like, okay, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to sneak out of my house. So can I tell people you snuck out of your house? Yeah, yeah. Do you think you're going to get in trouble?
It's a statute of limitations on your teen crimes.
I don't think they can ground you now. But so, you know, you snuck out of your house to go to artist studios and learn how to make art. And you are still, you know, you're curious and you're feeding that curiosity about making artwork. And you're still making artwork. And Dina, you as well. I know you are nonstop. Like, you make artwork every day. There is not an excuse in your head that tells you you shouldn't do it. And these are such special qualities for you to have, and that is the majority of the battle of being an artist.
Well, that's interesting thinking about that, and I would like to get Marina's opinion on this, because I see so many students come in and out now, and there is something about personality and grit that does really feel like it overrides talent a little bit. And when I project the future for students, it's like, are they gonna really work at this? You know, do you, when you're dealing with clients, do you sort of feel a similar thing?
Well, I mean, first of all, I just want to, I call my clients, just I call them artists.
Artists. Okay.
Because when I think of client, I think of collector, and that's not who I work for or with. But, you know, that kind of thing, talent versus this idea of just keeping going. You know, it's kind of like the comparison between like a brilliant musician and a performer, right? Britney Spears is a performer, but she's not a brilliant musician. Uh-huh. But yet she has this success as a performer. And so as an artist, you have to be able to also perform. Mm-hmm. And performing means making the work. Mm-hmm. And so I have seen, and, you know, I'm not saying that I have seen everything, because it's impossible to know everything about the art world, right? It's just so big.
Right.
But I have seen some artists who have been very, very successful, and they'll literally make one painting a year because they don't have that performance thing. You know, they say like, oh yeah, it takes me like 18 months to make this one painting. But really, it's because they're not in the zone all the time. And you need to be in the zone. And that is like the number one thing. But while you're in the zone, you can't, or while you're making work, you can't just arbitrarily keep making work. You need to be in line with your intentions. Mm-hmm.
I think that's one thing you're really helpful with. Intentions are so hard to pin down when you're in the middle of just like working on work, working whatever job you're doing to support yourself. And it feels like creative time is fleeting. And it's like, well, I'll just paint an apple today or something. And it's hard to know. For a lot of people, I see that if they have intentions at all, you know, and I do think that is such an important aspect of
so
it.
So important.
I feel like even making yourself paint that apple, like at the end of everything else, is like it, like it's still, like you know how people are like, I'm just not inspired today, and I've had like students tell me that, and I just like smack them.
Well,
yes.
I was like, oh, like you know what, inspiration is nothing. Like it's not nothing.
Yeah.
But it's like it's closer to nothing than everything. Like yeah, just go paint the apple.
But imagine how much more powerful it can be if you have intention, inspiration, and you're painting the apple. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that's really something.
Yeah. I mean, I also do have this, and maybe this is magical thinking. This belief that if you're not inspired for a while, it's okay. If you're not inspired for like 10 years, it might be a problem. But if it's, you know, if it's for a while and you just make yourself do stuff every day, eventually like your intentions will kind of clarify.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, one thing that I tell artists when they're trying to figure out what their intentions are, they're not so sure about whether or not their intentions are really their intentions, is I give them a little bit of an exercise. And the reason for this is that once they complete this, they're going to have an answer that will guide them. And when they just are uninspired, right? They're like, I don't know what to paint today. I feel like I should paint. And what I do is I tell, and our listeners can do this and see if it works.
A free secret.
Yes, Marina, you have free podcast secrets. I mean, also speaking of secrets, and
you're like the best guest.
And, well, I have a little bit more of advice, but also, so what I do is I tell artists to take a notepad, like buy one of those like little tiny notepads, or if you don't really feel like buying one, just have some paper on you at all times. And for a whole week, every time you think about your work, whatever comes into your mind, it has to be one word or maybe a phrase, right? But one thought, you write it down. And at the end of the week, you're going to have maybe 5 words, maybe 500, but they're all going to be kind of disconnected.
Okay.
And you look at them and you reread them and you think about them, because all of these words are like the tips of a cobweb, right? And at the center of that cobweb is your intention. And so you will find out what your intention really is. A lot of the time I meet with artists and I tell them, you know, your work is also very much about movement, for example. And they don't even realize that they're painting movement or representing movement in any way.
Okay.
And it helps them figure out what their the center of that cobweb is.
Just to clarify, how do you find the center of the cobweb again? It's
So at the end of this week, you will look through all the phrases, all the words that make you think of, that you wrote down while you were thinking about your work. It could be something like, you know, it's dark, it has people, it's about love, it's about buildings, you know, whatever it is. Or it could be really in depth, like, oh, you know, this has to do with
the nakedness of man in the face is absurd.
Yes, or like mechanical reproduction, and I don't know, whatever it is, fracking. And at the end of this, you should be able to look at all those little things that you thought about when you were thinking about your artwork and process them and come up with what you're painting or what you're working on, what you're making. It could be, you know, you might be an abstract artist working in mixed media. So whatever you're making, and that is, those words are going to guide you to your intention.
Okay. Interesting.
It's a little daunting sometimes because people don't want to pick up a writing utensil and write down what they're working on. But it's only for you to see, and no one's judging you.
You know, I actually relate to that, too. It is hard to pick up something and write on. I'm always like, where's the pen? Where's the paper?
Yeah, you come up with, like, a million excuses. I don't have paper. Oh, this pen doesn't work. but just, you know, just do it. It's for you. It's, you know, it's like journaling or something. Mm. But it's really, you know, I think of your sketchbooks as like all like Da Vinci sketchbooks, right? Like,
yeah, totally.
I mean, like you're not like exactly an engineer, like making helicopters.
I'd rather look at yours than Da Vinci's, yeah, for sure.
But we can't read yours. It's like too illegible.
Yeah, that's right.
You can't read his either, right? Without a mirror and without knowing Italian.
Oh yeah, see, there you go, you people. You geniuses.
One thing about Da Vinci's sketchbook that always bothered me was that people were like, oh man, he invented the helicopter on that. But it's kind of like, like you couldn't look at a bird or like the things that fall off trees and spin down and think helicopter. Like, I could draw a sketch of a teleportation machine in my sketchbook and people aren't going to be like, he invented the teleportation machine.
Well, Marshall and I say again on that.
It's like it's all out there. It's not,
I
like
think I figured out the future for you. Yeah. It's in your sketchbook.
Yes. And it's a teleportation
device.
Just
inventing machines that everyone's projected
about. You know
what's
actually really amazing about Da Vinci's sketchbooks is how much of a total asshole he was. Because each chapter basically, I mean, he's a genius. Each chapter basically starts off with like, amongst the many different types of idiots out there, the worst type of idiot is the idiot that thinks that they don't need to know perspective. And, you know, the next, like a few pages down, it's like,
that's
amongst
his worst idiot. I can think of a million more.
And he's like, amongst many types of fools, there's a type of fool that thinks that, you know, in order to know color, you don't need to know how to draw or whatever. And that to that type of fool, I say, you know? like he was just like a really ornery, really obnoxious kind of, he thought everyone was dumber than him, which they probably were.
Yeah,
but
probably
then,
true. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm glad you bring that up because one other piece of advice that I have for artists working today is it's so crucial for you to know about the history of artists, right? We study art history, right? When we study about the history of art, we study about paintings. We don't really learn a lot about how artist studios were run and what the protocol was for artists and how they sold their work until, you know, you get to graduate school and in your seminar on Renaissance art or whatever. You don't really hear about that. But there are certain things that are so inspiring, like Da Vinci's books or sketchbooks are like, for example, Giorgio Vasari's treatise on painting.
Yeah, for sure.
It's so interesting to read this and to see how the work was received and talked about. And one thing that I can't get out of my mind when I, especially with painters, is how appropriation is like a big thing right now. Or, I mean, it has been, and like everybody's kind of like appropriating things or copying mm-hmm. things. I mean, not everybody, but a lot of people. And I think about Cennino Cennini and his treatise on painting, where he says copying is the highest form of flattery, uh-huh. but you should always do it on a smaller scale so as not to magnify your mistakes. And, you know, this is really something, these little bits of wisdom, and they could be misconstrued as like rules on how to do things, uh-huh. but they're just really interesting anecdotes, and they will help you connect with the history of artists.
What is your personal take on that? It's a theme I've seen over the last, you know, 8 years for sure, of just like people directly copying some painting with like a twist or something, like making them funny or whatever, like, you know.
Or like throwing an extra something in there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You know, or like, I feel like I've seen several artists do this where they paint like a Renaissance portrait of someone, but it's like a contemporary person.
Yep, yeah, yeah, yeah. They're almost like insider art jokes in a way.
Yeah, but, well, you know, I'm torn because I really like that the artists who are doing this are talented enough to paint that way uh-huh. or, you know, to make artwork that way. But I also think that it's, you know, I get it. And I'm sure other people get it too. Like, you understand it.
Does it almost feel like a one-liner?
Like, you know, it's like a one-liner,
it's
yeah.
like you've put all this, like, amazing technical skill into, like, a knock-knock, not a knock-knock joke, but, like, you know.
What I'm saying is, if you're an artist who does this, you could keep doing this and be quite successful as long as you add on the layers of whatever your message is.
Like a personal message, is that what you're saying? Or
anything. Your intention, right? Okay, but it's not just that one-liner.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I feel like you're, like, kind of getting back to what you do. I feel like it's so important in a world where everything, in an art world where I feel like everything is catering to either, like, either the collectors or the, like, I feel like everything's catering to the other side, right?
Yeah. No one's really there to be there for artists anymore. Hmm. I mean, sure, like,
so schools are, and maybe, like, if you get really lucky with a gallery.
Yeah.
And find some place that really cares.
You know, I just want to make it clear to artists that there are certain things that they could do to be successful, you know, and whatever that success is.
So we started this, and I'm not sure if we're recording, but, we started this by, I know, like, me or Marshall going on about how hard it is to create.
Oh, we recorded that part.
To survive as an artist or as mm-hmm. a creative. Mm-hmm. And Marina's first bit of input is, it actually shouldn't be that hard.
Yeah,
And that's really inspiring, because I feel like, we've all been trying to do it for a really long time, and we're still, like, not... that great.
Well, okay, Dina, you have to reframe the way you think about what greatness is. Just, you know, with you, for example, I feel like I'm going to embarrass you by telling you this, but I think about all the things that you are successful at first, right? Like, think about the community you built. That is so freaking cool.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
that is.
Thank you, Maria. Trying to build
that that you're building, right? Right. It's ongoing. think about how fantastic, like, you are such, technically, you're an excellent artist. And also, you have shown, in such cool places and made such cool shows, and you were able to make your artwork your primary career.
Honestly, right now, if, like, my husband didn't have a real job, I'm not sure it would be. But
it is.
It has been through most of my life, at least. It's weird. Like, out of all of these things, like it's the only real success I feel like I've had in my life. It's just what we were talking about earlier, just keeping going, you know? Like keeping going.
And so...
I feel like it's only, like, real pride I take in it. Yeah. It was like, oh, and then there was, like, this year where nothing was selling, and yet I kept painting, and, you know, and then there's this year where the kid didn't sleep all night ever,
I'm sure there are years when everything is selling. But, you know, the message here is that when you are starting to doubt yourself, and you're starting to think about how you are lacking in something, balance it out by thinking about what's the best case scenario. And balance it out by thinking what you do have and what you are already successful at. And for somebody out of art school, like, you got out of art school, mazel tov. You survived. And you're going to survive the rest of your career as well. And you're just starting. But and people who haven't gone to art school and are artists and are making work and are just there, you're already making work. You didn't go to school. Like, you're good, and you didn't have to be taught. Although some people do, want to be taught. And
all right, guys, I think everyone should sign up for Session with Marina, because I'm already feeling better about my life. And we're just doing this podcast.
But also, you guys, if you want to sign up for a session, you can do it on my website.
All right, this is a good
idea. It's just theartistadvisory.com, and there's a special promo code for our listeners.
Oh.
So if you enter promo code THEGRIND.
Nice.
This is pretty amazing. Marina, by the way,
can I just tell them what the discount is?
Yes.
It's 20% off a session with me, and I can meet with you in person, or we can do it on the phone or via video chat.
Wow.
Thanks.
We got our first promo code.
We do, and now I feel really guilty because this won't actually come out till April.
That's great.
Speaking of which, kind of where do you see yourself as, you do something that's really necessary, I feel like, in the art world. No one else is doing it. Mm-hmm. Where do you see this heading? Where do you see yourself heading?
I think we should take a quick break.
Okay.
So hold that answer.
Yeah.
So we're back from the break. And Maria, I had a question for you. What advice would you have for an artist looking for a gallery?
So number one piece of advice is, do you really want a gallery? Why do you need a gallery? But whatever that answer is, why you need a gallery, you should also consider the different types of galleries there are. For example, if you just want to have a show so your friends and family can come and you're selling stuff out of your studio and you don't care about advancing your career in a very predetermined mainstream way, you don't care about having your work in museums.
Uh-huh.
You just want people, you're like a socialist and you want people to see it and have it.
Right.
But you're also a capitalist because you're selling your work. you might want a show in a gallery that's like a rental gallery.
That you would pay to rent.
You would pay to rent so you can show that.
Interesting, because I've heard advice not to do that.
Yeah.
Before. Yeah.
But I think Marina doesn't think that anyone would actually do that. I think Marina feels everyone should actually be looking for something else.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just saying there are some people that are cool with that, but most people want a gallery for a different reason, right? They either want to be part of a family.
Uh-huh.
They want to advance their career. They eventually want to see their work in museums. So how do you get there? And you get there by going to the right gallery. And I'm going to start at the very top of galleries, just quickly going through them. There is such a thing as a mega gallery or a blue chip gallery. And those galleries are galleries that have more locations than Starbucks. They are like David's Werner, Gagosian, and they sell work. In the way that they work with artists is that each artist has a liaison between them and the gallery. These liaisons help them facilitate whatever they need. They're really there for their artists, but they're also not necessarily personally connected to their director or the dealer. There's too many people working there, but it works for artists that want to just sell and be big and be in museums. And sure, if you're an emerging artist, it's highly unlikely you're going to get a show there, but it's also likely, you know, a little bit, it's possible. There's a chance. They have been known to do that. The next type of gallery is your run-of-the-mill commercial gallery that is quite large, maybe quite small, and it's akin to a mom-and-pop shop. And that type of gallery is the one where the director could also maybe be the owner. But there's usually about 5 people on staff, maybe 15 at most, if it's a really big gallery. And the one difference with how they deal with artists is that one director could be working with all the 15 to 20 artists that are represented in the gallery. Whereas in a mega gallery, one director works with 5 to 7 artists and has a little bit more time to focus on sales and growing their career and, you know, evolving their market, everything like that. Where, you know, in a commercial gallery, it's a little bit more about selling the work and getting it out. But there are some galleries that really have a sort of accountability with the kind of way they sell their work. And those galleries are usually ADAA members. ADAA is the Art Dealers Association of America. And this is a foundation. This was formed in like the 70s, I want to say. And it's a pure nonprofit organization for gallerists to double check on each other and make sure that everyone's doing things the way they should be done, that people are acting with integrity in the art world. Okay. And so looking for an ADAA gallery, that is gold. That is the gallery that's going to get you far.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
And so those galleries are mostly, I want to say they're mostly these types of commercial galleries, but they do things like artist talks sometimes, which is really special because you're not going to sell work from an artist talk, but you're going to essentially be a nice person to the artist, create a community. Next type of gallery is like a co-op gallery. And a co-op gallery is usually owned by a group of artists, and they own the gallery, and they have equal shares, usually. And so what happens is they rotate their chance at having a show. So let's say there's 12 artists. Every month, one of those artists is going to have a show.
Okay.
And they're responsible for their own PR. They're responsible for their own administrative, art handling. They're really, really hands-on, whereas like a mega gallery or an ADAA commercial gallery will do most of that work for you, and they will hire PR people on their own. Whereas if you wanted to have a PR person, which that's important when you have a show, because you want to get as many eyeballs as possible on your work when it's on display. right? It's on display, not to collect dust. And so you want to get PR press saying like, hey, there's a show, come look at it. And it always helps to have a story behind why you're showing and where you're showing and what you're showing. And a PR person is going to help you fine tune that story. You can also hire a person, a PR person on your own. There's plenty great ones, few very good ones, that you can hire if you, your gallery won't hire you a PR person. But, so going down the list, after the co-op gallery, the next gallery, and mind you, I started at the top because the top is the toughest galleries to really get chosen. Because everybody wants to show there. Because those galleries are going to, you know, it's like the spa of gallery, right? They're going to take care of you in every which way. They're going to fly you out and buy you a hotel room. Yeah, that's something a co-op gallery won't do. That's something not all commercial galleries are going to do. So one of the easiest galleries to get is a rental gallery. And that's where you rent out your space or a space to show your work. And this is something that might work for artists who just care about showing and selling their work and don't care about the machine of the art world. And so
sell their work at a gallery?
I have never known an artist to sell their work at a rental gallery in New York City.
How would you recommend someone shop for these galleries? If they find a bracket that they feel like they fit into, do you submit images? Do you knock on doors? Like, what's the...
So, look, knocking on doors and submitting images, I want to say, is mostly a thing of the past. Although it does give you a chance, but it's something like buying a lotto ticket, right? Yeah. You know, what is that chance?
Right.
The best way for you to start getting into these galleries is to start getting into the community around these galleries. And as an artist, you could reach out to other artists that are represented by the galleries that you want to be in, and you could say, hey, I really love your work. Can I do a studio visit with you? I'm an artist. Or would you want to come to my studio? I'd love to meet you. And maybe sometimes they'll say no, but there are some that will say yes. And this is how you start to grow your community. But on top of that, it's also very good to make yourself present at the openings. And this is such a difficult thing for some artists because they're like, well, who am I to go to this opening?
Right.
No one's paying attention to you. Just go. And, you know, if you so happen to run into an artist or you identify the artist who's showing, give them a compliment. They'll be happy to see you. And, you know, what would you do if you were them and you had a big show where you wanted to show and a young artist came up to you and said, hey man or woman, I love your work. Congratulations. What a beautiful show. How would you feel? You wouldn't shoo them away.
Right.
You might engage in conversation. So that's one very like, DIY way of getting in. Another way that artists are found nowadays is through artist residencies. And you go to the residencies to learn and evolve your work, but also you meet other artists. And it's kind of a tough thing, right? Because you have to go and work in a studio that's not your studio. You have to leave your house. So a good thing to do is like a summer residency that's like an hour, a month. Got my time mixed up. So something like that. But also there are residencies if you're listening in New York City or another major city, there's probably a residency near you where you don't have to move, but it's good to immerse yourself. And finally, one way that artists find galleries is the galleries find them
right
from lifestyle publications where they get press, but also from Instagram. Mm-hmm. I can't, I mean, there are galleries that find artists on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And I just want to give you a few tips about your Instagram and your web presence and to make sure that you're doing these things. So
let's hear
them.
Bring it on.
Bring it on. Okay. The number one thing I see that artists want to do is they want to put more than one link in the bio of their Instagram. There's a cheating way, like there's a way to cheat around that. You can tag as many people as possible as you want in your Instagram bio. And so if you just had a review in the New York Times, you could just put that in your bio by saying, read my latest review in the New York Times. And, you know, instead of saying the New York Times, say at New York Times.
Ah,
right? Nice. And so you still can leave your website there for people to see. Hmm. You should definitely have a website. But also when you're making your Instagram bio, I know that it's like this in the Apple operating system, but if you use Notes to write, to draft your bio, you can make the right spaces and line breaks that you want. And, you know, you can insert emojis too. And then you just copy and paste that into Instagram and it will stay formatted that way.
Oh.
So, you know, that's pretty major.
Yeah.
But that's advice for, you know, not even artists, anyone. So then the other thing that I want to ensure that you guys all do is you have a website. It's so important for you to have a website because it will make you look professional, like it's your thing that you do, and it is your thing that you do, right? You're an artist. Mm-hmm. So go on, you know, go on Format or Wix or Squarespace or whatever and make yourself a website. And when you make that website, make sure you do several things. Number one, you take out the home button. No one uses the home button. They just click on your name. It's no longer 1997. The other thing you do is you make a biography page because people that will look at your website don't all know how to read a curriculum vitae. They're not all from the art world. So you want to have a short 3 to 5 sentence paragraph about who you are, where you're working, what you're working on, and that's it. Just give them a little bit about yourself that's like a lens for them to look at your work through.
And is that like written in third person usually?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I look, I know half the time you're writing it, but I feel like you want to give the illusion that maybe somebody else has already written about your work, right? Yeah. We're manifesting other people writing about your work. I don't know. I like it written in the third person.
Yeah. Feels like people are writing about you.
Yeah. Before. You don't want to use I because it just sounds like you're in second grade to me. I don't know. There's probably logic behind it, but I haven't discovered it. So, and the final thing that I really urge every single artist to do when you have a website or if you have an Instagram too, but also like maybe another social media platform like Flickr, you want to be careful with how much work you are putting out there, especially if you are a painter or a photographer. Anyone, but especially painters and photographers. Why? Because as a painter and a photographer, you are sometimes making a good amount of work. You know, let's say you're having a great year and you paint 50 paintings that year, you don't want to make people think that your paintings are a dime a dozen. You want them to think that they're scarce, they're hard to get, and they are clear and succinct. So you curate what you show people. You curate what you show that falls in line with the intention of your work, right? So if you're a realist painter who specializes in still lives of tool sheds, like inside tool sheds, don't put any bathroom paintings in there.
Oh, okay.
Do you know what I mean? Just be consistent. But also try to put no more than 20 paintings on your website, because once you put more, people, they don't understand why it costs so much. And the same with photographers. As a photographer, you can take 200 photos of the same thing before you actually decide on the one photo that you want to publish. But you need to narrow it down even more, because it's, you want people to think that, and it's true that you do this, but that you put so much thought into every image you take, and it's not easy to get an image.
Well, what if you're someone who jumps series a lot? Like you have, you're like always looking to make the next body of work. And so it's that tool shed analogy. Is that, how do you organize that?
So it's different for every artist. One thing that you could do is you could look at the ways that you paint. Maybe you have different types, like modes of painting, or different ways of making the series that you can categorize them that way as well. So for example, maybe you just have, abstract meditations on the interiors of tool sheds.
Okay.
Right. And so that's a whole category. And they have sub-series. Like, okay, this one's like, it's red is the main color. And then this one is all about texture. And so you can categorize it that way. Mm-hmm. And then you have the representational ones.
Okay. Okay. I see.
So that's one way to do it.
Try to find some link in between the two.
But really, the ultimate link is that center of your spider web. What is your intention? Okay. Right? And are each of those series, are each of those things falling in line with your intention? Like, why are you painting still lives of things in the tool shed? Right? I mean, what is the point of that? And does it relate to interiors of the bathroom somehow? And that's where your bio paragraph comes in.
Okay, because you could explain, if you are doing bathrooms and tool, you could explain the link.
Yes. Thought of, I wish I thought of more glamorous examples, like castles and mansions.
They're very domestic.
Like, yes.
It. So I've noticed artists are, we're not good at asking for things. What would you recommend in that way?
So one thing that I think we touched upon earlier in this podcast is that we're raised to think of the artist as being a starving artist, that it's hard to make a living being an artist. And that has a lot of limitations tied into it, but it's also being afraid to ask for money for your work. And so this is why I'm urging you to make it clear and curate your work as being precious, right? It's like the ring in Lord of the Rings. Exactly.
So you take your own work seriously.
Yes, but also be okay with asking for money when it comes to your work. Be okay when somebody inquires over Instagram and says, hey, how much is that? Don't say it's $15. Because think about how much is it really worth, right? Think about how much time you spent making it. Think about how much time you spent learning how to make something like this.
Yeah, I think that's very important. Yeah.
Right? How much investment did you put into this?
All the years and learning and school and craft and all that. Yeah.
It's incredible. And then think about the value of your perspective as an artist. Mm-hmm. You're literally there to show people other ways to look at the world. Mm-hmm. And how valuable is that?
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. Do you see that as a big role for artists to show just perspective in general? Just, I know more about the world talking to you, you know.
It's your interpretation of it. And I don't think that it has to do with like how you, with any superiority thing, like, do you see it better than other people? Mm-hmm. You were just seeing it differently and you were broadening other people's horizons.
Okay.
But back to asking for money, when people ask you for money, or when people ask you, it's back to asking for money. When people ask you how much something costs and they say, great, I want to buy it. The next thing you do is you say, thank you. I'm so excited for you to have this. Where do I send the invoice?
Okay.
And you send an invoice. Mm-hmm. You can also go on my website for a template so you know how to fill one out if you don't yet.
Okay.
And on the bottom of that invoice, you say when it's due, you say how you can be paid. And the best thing to do is to say payable upon receipt. So the moment they get the invoice, they pay it immediately. Hmm. There's no arbitrary date they're waiting for. Hmm. And you can ship the artwork. But also say payable via Venmo, PayPal, check. Uh-huh. And if it's by check, make sure your address is on the invoice so they know where to send it.
Yeah. I think artists are so bad at that. Just the confidence to ask for money and things. Even the way that we refer to our own work. Do you have any strategies for how someone should talk about their work?
Or when asking for money? Work and money?
Yeah, sure.
Because this is really, really important. The moment you are asked how much something is, you might be inclined to describe why it's so expensive.
Uh-huh.
Or why you think it's so expensive. First of all, it's not so expensive. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, there's a painting that costs more.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
And if you make it clear that you're okay asking for this much money by saying, it's $5,000, it's $50,000, it's $70,000, whatever it is, you just finish there and you wait for their response. Mm-hmm. Because if they say something like, it's too expensive, be like, well, I would love to be in your collection. Why don't I extend a discount to you of 15%?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that's such a confidence issue for me in that way to even confidently say a price without sort of apologizing.
You know? Don't apologize. Think about how much it costs you to make the work.
Uh-huh.
And it's not just physical money and time, but it's also like your emotional well-being. Mm-hmm. And everything that goes into it.
Yeah.
And you have to think about artwork as like, it's similar to, think about it as like a surgery, right? If you were a surgeon and you learned how to do surgery on someone and it was open heart surgery and you go, okay, it's $100,000. You're okay asking for it.
Yeah,
so
right,
as an artist,
right,
you spend that much time learning how to do what you do and figuring out how to do what you do, whether in school or not in school.
Right. That's so true. You're always learning.
And whatever you've learned, you spent being an expert on, it's okay to ask for that much money.
That's great. That's so positive. I love your energy.
Thank
That's
you.
What we all need to. Oh, and you said something interesting earlier. It could have been on a break about calling your an artist calling their work. They shouldn't call it a piece.
Is that yes. So one pet peeve of mine is when an artist calls their work piece, because when I think of piece, I think of something trivial. Sure, it might stem from masterpiece.
Uh-huh.
But we're living in a world where people don't know masterpiece is a word anymore. And when you call your work a piece, people are confused. They don't know what it is that you made, right? So you want to be sure it's good to have mystery about how you're making the work and what it is. But let's say you are a painter like yourself, Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone is shocked at how real something looks and they're thinking, wait a minute, is that a real owl? Or is it, did he collage it in?
Uh-huh.
You know, you want to say my paintings.
Right, right, right. Uh-huh.
If you're a photographer, you want to say my photograph, not a print. Because okay. Let's say you're really into shooting in a way that looks painterly. And people might think it's like a lithograph mm-hmm. or something. You want to be clear about what you are making. And it makes you sound more professional and it gives more respect to your work.
Oh, that's great. Oh, I like that. Well, thank you so much for coming. This has been excellent and great. And give us your website one more time.
So my website is theartistadvisory.com. And if you'd like to book a session after listening to this podcast, use promo code THEGRIND for 20% off a one-on-one session with me.
Great. Thank you so much for coming. This is great.
Thank you. Did it.
Thank you for listening to the Art Grind podcast. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Also, we're on Instagram at Art Grind Podcast. You can leave comments on the thread or DM us there. We usually see them. Also, Facebook, we're at Art Grind Podcast. You can leave comments, future questions for our guest and such there. Our website is www.artgrindpodcast.com.
Definitely go there for the beautiful images that we post of the artist. And don't be shy to donate us money so we could buy some really good booze for the guests.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.